Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/new.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month is low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here with my good friend Alex Jordan of the Quincy Institute of Responsible Statecraft and co-host of their podcast, Always at War, this week, because Derek, to be honest, has Iran war maxed out. He will be back next week, stronger and better than ever, but he needed a little bit of a break, so he's going to take news off this week.
I sort of assumed that he had deployed, that's why he had deployed.
Yeah. Derek's actually a National Guardsman. Yeah. He's actually a Coast Guard military police. So he's been, you know, really, really on duty recently.
Fits his vibe.
But before we get into the news this week, just some quick reminders. In particular, we have released the first couple of episodes of our new series with the historian Andrew Hartman, Marx Prestige. The series examines the thought of Karl Marx and how his thought shaped and reshaped the United States. It's a sweeping history from the 19th century to today, or as I refer to it in the trailer, the most important political movement in history, millennial Marxism. So if you're interested in Marx's thought, Marx himself, and in particular, how he influenced U.S. politics, thought, and culture, please check that series out at marxprestigepod.com. It is $5, except if you are an annual subscriber, then you get the series as part of your annual subscription. And again, if you haven't yet, please consider subscribing to the podcast. We've done a lot of specials on the Iran war, most recently with friend of the pod, Hassan Piker, where we not only talk about Hassan's recent visit to Cuba, but also the fact that he has become the center of the Democratic Party this past week, even though there's other things going on in the world, Alex, I'm not sure you've heard, and what that might suggest about where the Democratic Party is. So that's at, of course, AmericanPrestigePod.com. And again, we really would appreciate it if you could like the show and review it on Apple. It actually does help us. And I just wanted to plug our Discord, which has been getting many members recently. Derek and I are on there. I mean, honestly, I'm on there more than Derek, but it's a really cool little community that we're developing. So if you subscribe to the podcast, you could have access to all of the channels on the Discord. And even if you don't subscribe, I believe you still have access to the general channel there. All right, Alex Jordan, pronouncing it like everyone is wants to pronounce it. Let's jump in to
the natural way.
The big
really quick before we jump in, are we gonna? I guess is there gonna be a condemnation of Hassan's sort of vile, hateful speech about?
I've started Jews for Hassan, so it's currently a group of one. But no, we are big fans of Hassan. I actually say this on the podcast. Like, doing what a streamer does is extraordinarily impressive. Like, just sitting being able to talk like coherently. Like, I cannot do that for the amount of time he does that, and it's wild.
I need the edits. I need producer Jake to help me out. I could not speak for 10 hours without.
And like
for nine
be compelling them, yeah. the entire time. Yeah, it's like a real it's a real skill. It's like nothing that I've ever seen. Yeah. But
let's jump in. The dude while he's under fire. God damn.
Yeah, Yeah, of course.
Let's get to it.
Oh, big fans. So let's talk about the big news of the week. And that is, of course, Ciara and West breaking up on Summer House. I'm just kidding. Let's talk about Trump addressing the nation about Operation Epic Fury. So, Alex, what is this big talk that everyone, you know, there was sort of the DC prediction. I wonder what the prediction, did the prediction markets have what you could bet on what he's going to talk about? I'm sure they did.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, have, but like, everyone was basically wrong.
Or whatever.
Yeah. So what did he actually say? Yeah.
He said that the war will go on for 2 to 3 more weeks. Don't worry about it. I mean, the speech was remarkable. I think my colleague Eli Clifton made a good point. Like, what was so remarkable about the speech is that, like, in the middle of this war, like a month in, with all of the crisis and chaos mounting, you know, they preempted a bunch of broadcast networks to put Trump up there, and Trump had nothing to offer. He said this war will go on for 2 to 3 more weeks, but also Vietnam took 19 years, and like, we're doing this for your children and grandchildren. It was all over the place, but mostly it just seems like he has no plan. Like, that's the main takeaway, is he said this war will continue for 2 to 3 more weeks, and actually the war is nearing completion. But if Iran doesn't come to the table, then we will destroy the country. And, you know, yet again, this is a pattern the listeners are familiar with, just threw out a whole new set of sort of objectives, which are changing week to week. I mean, there wasn't a lot new here. Like, if you just read Trump's Truth Social and sort of the day-to-day schizophrenic nature of how this administration talks about what it wants to achieve with this war, that was just like a live reenactment of that. But it's most concerning because it signals that Trump doesn't really have any idea of how to get out of this. Like, he's not going to be able to escalate his way out of this because Iran can cause serious, you know, pain in response. And if he walks away, there's like an, obviously it's a strategic defeat. Like, there's not been this significant change in the Iranian like regime, as they claim. I mean, obviously they've assassinated plenty of people, but the IRGC is strong. And obviously, like, the more hardline elements of the government are now like in control. And so the main takeaway from last night was, like, Trump doesn't have many ideas. There aren't any adults in the room, quote unquote, the things that people like to say about how things will work out. Like, this war is going by the whims of a dude who is not a particularly focused thinker or administrator. And yeah, that's reflected in the markets. Like, you sort of imagine that speech was almost primarily for the markets and for cooling economic heat. And oil prices like jumped dramatically, like right after the speech, because it was clear that Trump wasn't, you know, some people wanted to see him pull out and say, oh, this is how it's going to go. This is the exit plan. We don't have one. The exit plan is to get further into the war unless Iran capitulates in the next 2-3 weeks, which we know they won't do.
Do you think that there's any real chance that he's going to use nuclear weapons? Because, like, I think you're right that there's really no chance to get out of it in a way that would be amenable to however he might want to get out of it. But then what do you do? Do you just keep on saying it's going to be another 2 weeks? It's going to be another 2 weeks.
Right.
It's going to be another 2 weeks. The United States does have recourse to a strategic weapon that would break a nuclear taboo. But obviously he's old. He is dangerous. And there's no exit, really. And I guess it's difficult to know because you can't read his mind. But what are your thoughts about that issue? Which, to me, I almost never think about in terms of war. But curious your thoughts about that.
You do have sort of the perfect mix of elements. Like you mentioned, Trump's impatience, the fact that he is like old, he just wants this over. It's very clearly hurting his domestic political priorities. And you're right. Like, the thing I said isn't quite true. He doesn't have any escalation route for like escalation dominance, except for like the escalation dominance device that the US has thousands of, which are nuclear weapons. Like, and also Israel has got a couple of them too. So like, you could see a universe where they're so committed to doing this by air power and they don't want to lose any more troops than they need to. I mean, Trump threatened to bomb Iran, quote, back to the Stone Age. And that's what Pete Hegseth tweeted after the speech as well. And if I'm not mistaken, that phrase has its roots in our dear friend of the pod, Curtis LeMay, right?
I believe so. I always associate it with the early nuclear use period. If it's LeMay who used it, or it was probably common amongst those air officers.
Right.
In my mind, that's what I associate it with, at least.
But it's a if not, I doubt that this administration is consciously evoking history or whatever, but it might be an unconscious evocation of like how barbaric they're willing to go in being able to walk away with this is what they see as a political win. But I mean, that could be a strategic victory, but I think the fallout, not to be too clever, of the U.S. choosing to do that or the U.S. permitting Israel to do that would, I think, be like quite extraordinary and mark very clearly a new era from the post-World War II period. It's a scary prospect. Do you feel like it's on the table?
I do feel like it's on the table because I don't see how he's going to get out of it. I guess he could just escalate with troops. But I mean, that's been the one consistent position of his, you know, since he announced his presidency in 2015. So, and he's so old. And everyone dreams of being the last generation. So the apocalypse is
happen.
Yeah, he can make it happen. Not many boomers can, but he's in the position. All right, let's move on to the next topic and let's talk about related to this, which is a possible escalatory path, which is Karg Island and this commando raid to seize Iran's uranium. We actually did an episode about this a few weeks ago with a military analyst, Harrison Mann, that kind of ran through potential scenarios. That was free for all. So if you haven't checked it out, but Alex, tell us about this Karg Island commando raid potential thing.
Yeah. I mean, I won't go over the Karg Island thing because, like you said, folks should listen to that Harrison Mann episode, and he wrote a piece for Responsible Statecraft that's really, really good treatment on what that would really look like. The short answer is that it would be like pretty catastrophic and hard to hold, and it's not clear that it would meaningfully change the balance in this war. Like, it's an idea that is very, very Trumpy because it like is a nice headline, like the U.S. seizes this island to start trying to figure out how to control Hormuz. But like, it's a lot more complex than that. And so we are also hearing about a separate boots on the ground operation that the White House is mulling to maybe give themselves the sense of sort of tactical and strategic victory, which is a plan like out of Metal Gear Solid. Name your video game. Like, it's bizarre. But the idea is that we would send special operation forces into Iran to seize 1,000 pounds of Iran's highly enriched uranium. We would have to like excavate it out of a mountain or underground facility where it is being held. So we would be not only flying in like a bunch of special operations troops, but also excavation equipment. We would have to build a runway inside of the country from which that we would depart with the highly enriched uranium with a cargo plane. It is like far and away would be the most ambitious special operations forces mission imaginable. And if you guys remember, like one of the very first special operations tactical failures was in Iran under Jimmy Carter when they, you know, tried to get the hostages out via helicopter.
And a helicopter crashed. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So there's not exactly this history of Iran being like the easy playground of the special operations forces, but it's unclear. Like, again, Trump is so not saying anything new, but what does he want? Like, he told Reuters that he doesn't care about the uranium. And he said in the speech, I think it was in the speech, like, you know, they can't ever go back and get it. We'll be watching. And if we ever see Iran try and retrieve this uranium, we're going to bomb the shit out of them again. So it's not clear if he really cares about this or not. It's just a thing he's saying. You know, you're having these battle plans litigated in the press. We're just in this like totally bizarre, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of precedent for U.S. military operations. It's just like the public experience of this war and the debate and like how feckless the White House seems from the start and how not supported it is by like people who love to support almost every war in Washington. We're just at this fascinating moment. And I don't know where Trump's going from here.
So Iran is, of course, itself responding. Let's talk about its threats to American tech companies, as well as its recent strike on a Kuwaiti tanker and what this might suggest about Iran's approach to claims about diplomatic negotiations at this point in the war.
Yeah, absolutely. So Iran this week, you know, issued a threat against U.S. companies' assets in the region. You know, Apple, Google, Meta, you know, these folks have presence in the Gulf. And the IRGC is saying, you know, in response to the destruction of Iranian infrastructure, like we've seen U.S. and Israel strike, not only schools and medical facilities and universities, but also steel plants, like things that are fundamental to Iran's economy and ability to function as a country. And we recall Trump said he was considering destroying Iran as a nation if they didn't listen to him. So Iran is threatening U.S. companies' infrastructure in the region as a response. And so, you know, we'll see what that looks like. There have been strikes overnight. I saw in Isfahan, you know, this war is going to continue, and the ability for there to be sort of spiraling escalations, not only against U.S. assets formally, like military assets, but U.S. companies and, you know, creating further destruction in the region. It seems like that's an obvious path. And why might Iran take that path and not embrace diplomacy? It's because they don't trust the U.S. I mean, there's a story.
How could they? Alex, I want to like sit on this for just 1 second, because like this is another thing that makes it seem like there's no way out of escalation, because they just fundamentally won't be able to trust the United States at all, right? I just don't see, like fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice within the span of 6 months, I can never trust you again. So, or was it 6 months? Maybe it's longer than that. Sorry, folks. I'm not time maxing right now. But like, how could they? This is, do you see, like, this is the other thing. Like, Trump isn't going to be able to get what he wants. And Iran fundamentally cannot trust diplomatic negotiations. So that's also why I don't see like a path out of this. Is there a way they would be able to trust this, or not really?
I mean, I think the idea of what it would take is significant concessions that would be politically painful for Trump. And that's probably why we won't see it happen, is that Iran wants sanctions relief. Like, it wants some sense of genuine guarantee that this won't happen again. And I think to them, they don't trust the U.S. word, right? And so the best way they can do that is to further integrate Iran into the global economy and the global system. I mean, to end its isolation formally, both, you know, in the global system, like the international system, and then the global economic system. And so that is why the path out for them has to be meaningful sanctions relief, meaningful openness to the world, an ability to become a part of the global community again, because they're not going to trust U.S. assurances or U.S. guarantees in a ceasefire. They need other things to restrain the U.S., like the idea that they can't restart a war with Iran because Iran's relationship with, you know, global, with the partners in the region and with China and whatever have grown so much, or that there is U.S. investment in companies that are investing in Iran, you know, just creating some sense of a cost for the U.S. to restart this war, because they need there to be a cost, because there's no trust. And that's the New York Times reporting last night, that like, for Trump is saying, you know, okay, you have to strike a deal in the next 3 weeks, or else we're going to start destroying your energy infrastructure. And they don't trust the U.S. Like, that the ability to make a deal is quite limited. And so for all the reasons you said, like, it's hard to see this coming. And, you know, Iran's, I guess it was foreign minister, is it Karzai, who was like struck a bomb in the last like 36 hours. Like, there is just this continued sense that the U.S. and Israel are not operating in good faith, which has been proven repeatedly from bombing of the, you know, of the negotiating table twice in the last six or however many months. So, the dynamics here all point in one direction in its escalation. Trump will have to really bulk. He will have to really, I mean, we've already seen it. Trump has already given that sanctions relief to the Iranian oil. I mean, that was significant. That's the same sort of sanctions relief that Trump railed against Obama last night in his speech for giving. It is the same sort of thing, like allowing Iran to make profits off of its oil revenue. And so there's a path, and Trump can clearly sort of lie, has no problem just lying about the reality of the deals he makes. So he's going to need to do that, and he's going to need to offer real concessions that make Iran feel like there's a significant cost for the U.S. and Israel to restart this war. And that can't just be that the U.S. and Israel would never break their word, because that's clearly not a good assurance for them to rest their security on.
Yeah, they're Limaxing. All right, let's move on to the worldwide economic consequences of this war and how those have proceeded in the last week.
Yeah, it's looking like the Hormuz closure under the Iran war is on set to be the largest oil supply disruption in history. Is that good? Do we know if that's good? I think that it might be not good if you put oil in your car.
Well, I'm just it'll be interesting. Maybe everyone will just go work from home again. Like if I'm remembering correctly, I believe this is true, but don't cite me. Look it up. One of the reasons that we have such long winter breaks in the United States, it's a consequence of the oil crisis of the 70s, because it was costing people so much, colleges and universities so much, to heat their dorms and offices and classrooms in the winter, that they actually, that's why we have this quite long winter break as opposed to the spring break, which is only a week or so. So you might see these types of social changes. I mean, if it becomes for an extended period, $6, $7, $8 a gallon. I mean, people are just not going to flat out be able to afford it, especially because we're in a moment of low declining employment and inflation. So we're in a stagflationary moment with oil shocks. So if you look at the 70s, the oil shock happens and then stagflation happens years later. To have them both is like truly economic catastrophe, especially in an era whose oligarchical inequalities have exceeded the Gilded Age. So this is like a maelstrom of terrible economic collapse, and that could lead to like social changes, like working from home.
Well, I guess if Trump via the Iran war delivers the 4-day work week to the American worker, unfortunately, MAGA
we might have to support it. A tactical nuke here or there. That's okay.
So yeah, I mean, I think that's a very interesting point. I mean, I think countries are really, you know, going to emergency measures here. Like the Philippines has declared a national energy emergency. Pakistan has a 4-day government work week now. They've closed schools. Thailand is rationing gasoline. China has banned oil product exports. Kenya and Uganda and like various African nations are starting to report acute shortages. We'll talk a little bit later about the impact in Sudan. Brazil, you know, seeing fertilizer prices skyrocket. Like the shocks are everywhere. It's a reminder of what we saw in 2022 around Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And there were, you know, serious shocks that we've now surpassed, like already in a month of this war. And it's not looking like there's going to be a stable position going forward. So I mean, how many times can I say different versions of like the outlook is bad to really bad? And it's almost like all the people who warned about how stupid and fucking disastrous this war could be had a point, because we're going to see some serious economic shots that we've not even felt yet. And that's just over the next two to three weeks. If we're staring down 6 months of this, I mean, like you said, stagflation, I mean, we're in a dark time, the dark age.
Yeah, what did people used to say? Hell world. We're in hell world, yeah. Alex. Let's bring out some 2015
hell yeah
weird Twitter content. let's move on to past Iran or somewhere else in the world. Let's talk about Europe. And in particular, a lot of talk before Trump's speech on Wednesday was about whether he's going to announce either a disengagement of the United States with NATO. I believe that the United States can't actually leave NATO without congressional authorization, but he could issue an executive order and do stuff regardless. Mm-hmm. But is NATO fracturing? So I think let's start with France blocking American overflights and then go on to Trump threatening Ukraine aid. And again, this NATO exit that everyone was talking about.
Yeah, so Trump is getting sort of increasing rebukes about the Iran war as the global costs rise economically. France blocked the U.S. military from like using its airspace to fly towards Iran, called Trump Trump then called Paris very unhelpful. Macron this morning called Trump unserious and on Iran and unhelpful on NATO. So there's like a war of words going here. You know, Trump is trying to goad NATO into doing something about the Strait of Hormuz closure that he caused via his war. Europe says they're not interested. But here's the thing. Trump, because he is the president of America, which holds a superior position over Europe geopolitically via NATO, Trump is threatening, if NATO countries don't get involved in unblocking the Strait of Hormuz, that they will no longer use U.S. military supplies and the like Pearl weapons procurement program, the deal where Europe buys American weapons for Ukraine. Trump is threatening to halt that. So he's threatening to halt the weapons aid to Ukraine, which was always a possibility that weapons aid to Ukraine would be subject to U.S. whims and U.S. war fatigue and all these things that people who have been pushing for diplomacy, like myself, have warned against. And it's happening that Trump is, you know, using his leverage vis-a-vis Europe with Ukraine to try and sort of bully them into helping fix the problem in Hormuz that he created. So there's a lot of bad feeling. Yeah, there was this reporting that Trump was going to like effectively pull out of NATO in the speech. And to your question, like, yes, it's true that the Trump technically can't pull out of NATO, you know, because of a law passed with the help of his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. But the reality is he has full power to unilaterally close U.S. bases in Europe. So like he could effectively kill NATO without crossing the legislation if he wanted to, you know, a bunch of base closures and withdrawal that the president has, you know, full legal authority to do would certainly send a message to NATO and fracture the alliance further. So, I mean, this is, you know, talk about Trump, the disruptor. You know, this war has like heightened the contradictions. Talk about 2015 speak. Like we really are seeing these unspoken tensions in the U.S. approach to the world become very fractious and a possibility for change. I guess a plastic moment is what you might call it. Like
one might call it a plastic moment.
So I'm very curious to see how this plays out. But yeah, like Macron throwing insults back at Trump this morning, I don't think it's going to de-escalate anytime soon. Trump's NATO emissary, I'm forgetting his title, that guy Whitaker said yesterday that, you know, NATO needs to understand, you know, we could end this thing, we can pull out. So the administration is going about as far as it's gone and threatening sort of the end of NATO, because NATO without the U.S. is not much of a military alliance, let's be real.
Yeah, I mean, Europe is definitely going to move toward its focusing on its defense industrial base. I think that is happening no matter who wins the next election. Yep. So I think this is a breaking point of NATO. Specifically how it happens is difficult to know, but I believe it is in the process of happening. All right, let's turn to Israel. And let's begin with Israel deepening its occupation of Lebanon, raising villages there and killing UN peacekeepers.
Yeah, man. I mean, the headline's so fucking depressing. So this week, Israel did kill three UN peacekeepers or Israeli troops. And that's among the more than 1,300 dead in Lebanon so far since they've restarted this front and the occupation, which was sort of timed up with the Iran war. Israel's now displaced over 1 million people in Lebanon, and they have declared that 600,000 of these civilians are completely prohibited from returning to their homes south of Litani River indefinitely until Israel says so. So is there any historical precedent for Israel displacing people and saying, hey, we'll get you back home later? I think that might be instructive about what could happen. So there's discussion in Israeli government about expanding this war, annexing southern Lebanese territory. You know, Netanyahu has signaled his support here. Trump is backing this fully. So this has to be seen as a part of Israel's continued further sort of expansionist view of the region and its desire to fracture the states around it and create its own security by creating insecurity for others. And boy, howdy, it is pissing off everybody around Israel. Who could have seen this coming? And the U.S. is, you know, backing it to the hilt. So nothing new there, but just more pretty bad trajectories.
Yeah. Again, it seems like Israel might emerge, at least in terms of its geostrategic goals, victorious here, more than anyone. I mean, I don't think those goals are going to be successful even in the medium term. I think it is just too small a country to be regionally dominant in the way that I believe Netanyahu and the right wing, and not only the right wing in Israel, imagines. So I think it's creating the conditions for a very unstable regional hegemony, particularly because it's going to rely so much on the United States for essentially eternal support. And I don't think that is going to necessarily be there. Particularly, I think the Democratic Party is flat out turning away from Israel. We could get into what that means in probably a future episode. But it might win its short-term strategic goals here. It might actually achieve them. Speaking of, let's turn to Gaza and let's talk about the Board of Peace, whose disarmament plan has been made public.
Yeah, so we got the full text of the Board of Peace's Gaza disarmament proposal this week. And under the plan, Hamas and all armed factions within Gaza must fully disarm over 8 months. They must surrender, any tunnel network, yield, security control of the territory to the U.S. backed, like, technocratic committee that will govern that. And that all has to happen before there's any reconstruction, before Gaza has made anything resembling remotely livable, while Israel is allowed to retain a military presence across, like, more than half of the territory. And, you know, there's no particular timeline or expectation of when they might withdraw. This disarmament plan still does not include sort of steps towards some sort of Palestinian statehood, any sort of appearance of accountability for the genocide, and really no way that Israel's own commitments will be enforced. I mean, you have to trust that the U.S. will come down on Israel if it violates its commitments under the deal. But we've already seen with the so-called ceasefire in Gaza, no one is pressuring or punishing Israel for not following the rules. Same with, we're going to talk about it today, but I know you guys addressed it last week, like growing settler violence in the West Bank. Like, there's just no particular pattern or reason to suspect that Israel will be held to its commitments here. So this creates the issue that we talked about with Iran. Like, if one side has no trust in the diplomatic process, like, how exactly or why exactly would Hamas go forward with this disarmament? Because it will mean that they've lost their last veto against Israel just running the table with whatever they want in Gaza. So we're, like, once again at a place where the diplomatic formalities have continued, but we get to the hard question of disarmament. And that really would be a significant change in the power equation of resistance against Israeli occupation and Hamas's power. And it's hard to imagine that they will just go forward with a plan that seems like a sort of green light for Israel to, like I said, run the table. So it's there. The disarmament plan is there. Whether or not it's going to move much further is the real question. And the answer seems like no.
Let's wrap up our coverage of Israel by talking about this new death penalty law that was passed and the United Nations response to it.
Yeah, man, this one is really grim. Israel's Knesset passed a law this week that's mandating death by hanging for Palestinians convicted of killing Israelis. There would be an execution within 90 days of this conviction, no opportunity for appeal or pardon. The law applies exclusively to Palestinians tried in Israeli military courts, which carries an absurd conviction rate, like something like 96%+ of Palestinians who appear in this place, are convicted sometimes based on confessions extracted through torture. The thing that's remarkable here is that this is a race-based law, not the first in Israel's case, Israeli settlers who killed Palestinians would not face this judicial process. So a different law for Palestinians than Israelis under the same system. Is there a word for that? Is there a popularized term for treating people disparately on their race formally in a de jure fashion? Is it apartheid? Yeah. So it's a really grim, not least because you see videos of like Ben Gavir or whatever popping champagne, talking about, you know, this is where we're going to kill thousands of Palestinians. I think this is pretty plainly planned for a war crime, or many, many successive war crimes being planned in public. In the U.S. says Israel has a right to pass its own laws. So once again, where's the accountability coming? I'm not seeing it. So another grim headline. I think that the next one might bring a slight amount of hope or uptick. I don't know, man.
All right, Alex, let's talk about this slightly hopeful news item, which is Cuba and a Russian tanker has broke the blockade. And again, everyone check out our episode with Hassan, who was just in Cuba, to talk about how it's actually really affecting people on the ground.
Yeah, we'll file this one under like the most hopeful news, and it's still not very hopeful, but we'll take it. For Russian oil tanker was able to dock at Cuba's port, I think just yesterday, with something like 730,000 barrels of oil. The reason this is significant is because the U.S. has been blockading Cuba and has, you know, issued threats against any country delivering oil to Cuba. So there was concern that this Russian tanker would, if not set off an international geopolitical incident, a la Cuban Missile Crisis, like the U.S. facing off with a Russian tanker outside of Cuban waters. That didn't happen. So that's a good thing, because Cuba is in dire straits. The 730,000 barrels is not enough to relieve Cuba's crisis. Their healthcare system is in free fall. There are something like 96,000 pending surgeries that cannot be done without the energy, some millions of people with chronic illnesses who don't have access to medicine, pause and cancer and dialysis treatment for some 20,000 patients have been interrupted. Like, not just the healthcare, the education system, food access, everything is straining under this blockade. And so Trump, in his utter unpredictability after issuing, you know, very dire threats against providing Cuba with an ounce of oil, said, oh yeah, that's no problem. And he said, it said something to the effect of like, I actually don't have a problem with countries sending oil to Cuba, which hopefully is a signal to people like Mexico's Claudia Sheinbaum, to Brazil, others who have, you know, balked at providing further assistance to Cuba in the face of these threats, or if not balked, sort of like tried to navigate them precisely. Maybe they'll just take this opportunity to try and do what they can to alleviate Cuba's crisis. But the crisis continues. We'll take a little bit of good news, 730,000 barrels of oil, while Trump is looking elsewhere, I guess.
Let's talk about this U.S.-China summit.
Yeah, sure. So there was a Trump-Xi summit that I think would have happened already had not been for the Iran war. Trump was scheduled to travel to China, but he postponed it because of the war, although he didn't exactly say that. But anyway, the summit is back on. The reason this matters is because obviously the U.S. and China, the world's two foremost powers, if the Iran war doesn't go into World War III, this is our next best option for seeing the new world war that American prestige heads are waiting for. So we'll see what's on the docket. It is probably a less ambitious summit than would have happened before the Iran war, because Trump is waging a war that is rather unpopular. I think she will probably want to avoid being too friendly, too much public appearance together. However, there are still major issues that the U.S. and China need to talk through. Most importantly, like deconflicting around continued tensions in South China Sea with the Philippine stuff, obviously around Taiwan and building a better assurance and crisis management sets. There are all sorts of things that they should look to work with. And China is actually trying, or like put its hat in the ring a little bit as a peacemaker alongside Pakistan when it comes to the Iran war, because China and Asia will feel the Iran oil disruptions most acutely, because that's where a lot of the oil that is currently being blocked is going. And so China has got a great interest in seeing this war end. But also this war is scrambling the U.S. alliance system, like we've already talked about. And the U.S. like pulled interceptors out of South Korea and Japan and like countries that it is previously using as sort of a bulwark against China. They're now sort of seeing what happens when the U.S. attention gets sunk back into the Middle East, as it always does. So hopefully this war will move the U.S., will give the U.S. and China a reason to talk more about being productive partners and building a stable world. But the real question is, does Trump really care about building a stable world if he's willing to blow up the global economy over Iran? We'll see, but I think everybody should hope that the U.S. and China maybe do a little bit of deconfliction, a little bit of lowering the tensions at a time when there's a lot of frickin' tensions.
Let's move on to Sudan, and let's talk about the RSF seizing Kirkuk.
Yeah, so the RSF seized Kirkuk in the Blue Nile state. This is the latest development in, you know, RSF opening new fronts in this war. Is the Blue Nile, Kordofan, I believe is how it's pronounced. It's seeking to, you know, stretch the resources of the army and try and make it a more difficult task. We'll see if it succeeds. I mean, the Iran war has already made a pretty grim situation in Sudan worse. They're facing the drug shortages that other countries are, obviously the fuel and energy concerns, obviously the food concerns as well. So these things are all would heat up already pretty intense situation there. Like I said, RSF making gains, opening new fronts. So this war, you know, what has it been going? Three years, yet another that will continue on.
And let's talk about South Sudan, which is also now sliding back into civil war.
Yes. Yeah, so the UN Security Council released a report that is basically forecasting something that experts have been saying, but you know, puts an imprimatur on it, that these elections that were planned for December 2026 in South Sudan, which would, you know, be a part of this deal that originally was struck in 2018 to cool the civil war or end the civil war, these elections can no longer be held credibly. And so that effectively, it's looking like the peace process, which had tenuously, you know, held, has collapsed. And the latest signal, this is not the like most obvious signal of this. There was obviously like the imprisonment of the former vice president this past spring. And then the dismantling of the unity government and this new insurgency this past winter that displaced some hundreds of thousands of people in the Yonglai state. And so I wish Derek is here, because he knows this much better than I, but I do know that this is something that we should be stressed out about. I don't know if we have any other conflicts to monitor, but tenuous diplomacy collapsing is not a new story. And as always with these crises, like I talked about with Sudan, South Sudan's situation will be exacerbated by a bunch of external outputs being more expensive and less predictable.
Let's conclude with another depressing story, and that is the United Kingdom is planning to cut aid to Africa by more than half over the next 3 years.
Yeah, so the UK is, I guess, maybe following the political window opened by Trump and Musk to question the role of Western powers in providing this sort of like critical aid, particularly to Africa. So the UK has announced it's looking like the UK will cut aid to Africa by more than half over the next 3 years, because this is part of a commitment to slash development spending so that they can further fund defense spending, which is what you were talking about, Danny, Europe arming up in the face of, you know, NATO fracturing. So, you know, the UK is a major, major donor country to African nations in need of critical food and medical aid. And particularly after the US has withdrawn its role as sort of like this international aid engine, it's a very concerning development, because if all of these countries that used to be donor countries move from spending on aid to spending on military, which is looking like what a lot of them will. I mean, the U.S. is looking towards a $1.5 trillion military budget proposal this year, after it was just $1 trillion last year. So all these countries are looking to cut down their spending where they can, and helping starving and dying people far away over the horizon is apparently a really easy cut to make these days. I mean, there's all sorts of conversations to have about the ways that foreign aid builds and enables different forms of domination by the West. I'm by no means naive about the US and UK's intent when it comes to some of its aid programs. However, still, these aid programs save lives. And if you're a person who is like a humanist like me, you would like to see some version of a geopolitical system where we agree on some common investment in the betterment of the world or whatever. But how naive does that sound in 2026 when we're moving towards World War III? But yet another signal. I don't know. Do you have any investment advice, Danny? Is there anything we can close with? how do we profit off of all this misery? What do
Let's start a defense consulting firm.
That's the answer.
That's what a lot of academics, come foreign policy analysts do. Well, Alex, the times, they are changing. That's a phrase that I came up with. So copyright it to me.
I love it.
It's a good one.
You're a great folk hero.
Alex, thank you so much for joining me. Everyone, check out marksprestigepod.com. Consider subscribing to American Prestige. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Peace.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.